Session number 9, we're going to deal with how to organize and use a Bible study library. And then the next session, session 10, will follow hard on that, and it'll be how to become an excellent Bible reader. Brother Roger will then give us a 5-minute bio break between the two sessions, and then he'll operate both of those. Okay? So, session 9. Here we go. Brother Roger?
Thank you. Okay, well, let's crack on with this in terms of seeing how quickly we can get through it. Although I don't want to do an injustice to it, but I do want to hear some good more readings. So I hope you've all got some really good choices to pass on to your friends and compatriots. So how to organise and use a Bible study library. So if we're going to start a Bible study program, we're going to need to have a Bible study library. So I have got some thoughts about that. And do you remember that there is a verse in the book of Ecclesiastes that says that there is a danger of being overwhelmed by books? Do you remember that? Of making books, there is no end. But the reality is that a Bible study library becomes a resource in terms of our own Bible study activity that I think is enormously useful. But we have to have some methodology to it. So I'm going to systematize it for you. It's really about this, that if you're going to be serious about knowing Bible truth, then you need to realise from, I think, early on in your study journey, is that you want to have good resource available. Good resource. Good study resource. Generally, if you've heard someone give a good study, I regret to advise that you'll find that most of them haven't brilliantly thought of all those ideas totally on their own. Sometimes they have, but they probably have also read good books, and they might have better books than you. And the quality of that spiritual resource has some impact on the quality of our studies. And personally, I think that's a good thing, and I'm going to actually talk tonight about the wisdom of plagiarism, in terms of understanding how that should be used. So do you remember what my first rule was? Try to accumulate at least 7 books for future study in all parts and aspects of Scripture. I remember being in our ecclesia once, and there was some new books that arrived in our ecclesial library, and there was a particular volume, and I said to this young brother, "You thought about buying that? It's a great book." He said, "Oh, no, I don't think so. I'm not studying that at the moment." I thought, "What? But you might be in the next 50 years. You're never going to study that book? You don't buy books based on what you're studying at the moment. You buy books based on anything you think you might want to study. And I bought everything because I wanted to study everything. My pocket money's gone long since being devoted to acquiring, you know, books for my study library, because I might want to study that one day. Also, I might want to study that. That's going to be important. In fact, I have a son that's similar to me. This is not Nathan, but it's Jacob. We visited the Christadelphian office. Bad mistake. And brother was taking us around the library at the Christadelphian office, and Jacob came out with about 30 books. And he looked at me with this very intense look, and he said, "Dad, I need these. I need these for my Bible study." Well, you know, what's a dad going to do? I mean, he just played the trump card, didn't he? But he had such an earnest look in his face. "I need these for my Bible study." Brother. But the thing is that you've got to start that early. You know, be serious in terms of building a study library. Funny thing is, I've got brothers that will come to me in our meeting that are older than I. They say, "Have you got a book on so-and-so?" And I say, "Yes, I have." "Oh, can I borrow it?" "Sure." I think, I wonder why in the last 50 years of their life they've never thought to buy a copy of that for themselves in terms of their own study library. Or did they think I was building one for them as well? And then I looked at my charge-out rates and decided they clearly thought I was building one for them as well. And why would we bother to buy a copy when we can use Roger's library? And in fact, as part of my personal attention management system, I have a little task list that I keep. And one of the things I teach with people in terms of attention management is that, do you have a task list? Hands up those who've got a task list of things to do, all right? Most of you will have one of those because it's part of the reality of life. One of the aspects of my task list is a section called Waiting on Others. And Waiting on Others is a list that you keep for whenever you've delegated a task for someone else. Because what the brain does, and it's called the Zeigarnik effect, is that the moment you delegate a task to someone else, it erases that matter and says, well, that's done now. Whew, gone. Actually, it's not gone, it's just delegated. At some point in the future, that problem surfaces, and you think, well, why hasn't that happened? Well, that's right, I delegated the so-and-so, but they've never come back and finished the job off, and more importantly, I never followed them up, and I didn't follow them up because I didn't have anything on my system that said, has that person ever come back to me on that matter that I delegated? Well, I don't drop those balls because I've got a section called waiting on others. So every time I delegate something to somebody else, that comes back up as a memory system at the appropriate point to say, has this person come back? And one of the things that my waiting on others folder is generally full of is, has Brother so-and-so returned this book? Has Sister so-and-so returned this book? Has Brother so-and-so returned that book delivered to them on such and such a day? And they come up on my system. And I have to do that because I've lost some books to brethren who've borrowed my books and never returned them. Which you wouldn't think would happen in the brotherhood, would you? Common theft. And because of my background, if I can put it that way, the thought of providing books free of charge for the long term doesn't sit well with me. So I think one of the best aspects of reading books is to realise that books so wonderfully enrich us in terms of the shape and breadth and character and depth of wisdom, because it's going to do something good for us in terms of that. And so this is about the value of good plagiarism. Now, so I just talk about plagiarism. Bad plagiarism, and I have had this happen, is where the brother stands up, uses your slides and your notes, and then presents it as his talk. That's not good plagiarism. Especially when someone else says, but I know where those slides come from and they're not yours. The font's wrong. But good plagiarism is when you read Brother Thomas or Brother Roberts and you wrestle with what Brother Roberts says and you say, why did Brother Roberts say that? And in the end you think, now I've got it, because he was saying that because he's actually linking Matthew with Hebrews, and because of what Hebrews says, that probably is what Matthew means. And so I think Robert Roberts is right now, and so I put a note in my margin that says, see Matthew 27 and Hebrews, and underline the key words that Brother Roberts is obviously alluding to, and now I can quote Robert Roberts and say, of course you realise that such and such and so and so, and I quote Robert Roberts. But you see, what I've done is I've wrestled with that idea until I've made it my own. And this is why I come back to having physical books. I like to, by the way, I don't literally wrestle with the book, but I like to wrestle with the ideas in the book. And for me to do that is a very tactile experience. I want to grab the book and I want to thumb it backwards and forwards. What did he say back there? Hang on a minute. And I want to be able to question it and pencil it and underline it. And in the end, I want to say, yes, I agree with that. And now that's not just Robert Roberts' idea, it's Roger Lewis's idea. But I've taken ownership because I've actually, if you like, sweated on that matter until I finally accepted the ownership of that idea. But it hasn't come without cost. But now it's my idea as well. Because it was never going to be Robert Roberts's exclusively. You can't actually put a mortgage or a lien on ideas. But what you can never do is simply cut and paste ideas and then pretend that you're your own without having done the due diligence behind being convinced for yourself. And of course, where you get tripped is if you simply do borrow an idea from someone else and quote it, and someone says, but that's wrong because of so-and-so and such, you think, I didn't know that. And you get caught out because you've simply articulated someone else's idea, but you hadn't wrestled with it enough. But that's what the point of having good books is about, is we're going to actually turn those ideas into our ideas. That's good plagiarism. Brother Thomas would be delighted if you quoted him, having wrestled with what he said and being convinced that he was right. That's exactly what he'd want you to do. So there's something sensible about that. And moving on from that is you want to seek, therefore, I think, as a priority to accumulate a comprehensive library of our own Christadelphian community with a particular focus on the earliest publications. And I'll tell you why, particularly Brother Thomas and Brother Roberts, and I'll tell you why. Because they live and breathe the Spirit of God manifestation in their writings. And we're in danger of losing that. I think that it's still a good idea for ecclesias to have a study class on a pioneer writing, because they've got a different atmosphere about them. And when ecclesias start to drift away from that, that that atmosphere of God manifestation that this absolutely saturates the way Brother Thomas thinks and writes, I think there's a loss to the community, because I think that's the pillar of our community, God manifestation. It's lost, can be lost very quickly. So develop a library of a resource that begins at least with a good stock of Christadelphian writings. I might have mentioned this to someone else on this journey here, on this particular trip, but we did something at one of our Bible schools that was quite interesting. If you imagine a room about this size, but only going back to the doorway. So if you imagine a full square coming through here and then back out to the doorway, and imagine that is the doorway is where it was, then along this wall we had basically a trestle desk like this, desks right to the end, and then right along here, and then right down there, and then right back there, and then back to the door. Actually, it wasn't back to the door because there's pretty well not enough room to come back to the door. Now imagine a room like that with a table set up right around it. Got it? And what we then did is we started in a certain year of the 1800s when Brother Thomas wrote his first publication. So whatever that was, what do you reckon that would have been, by the way? So if Elpis Israel was 1848, anything written before Elpis Israel? So let's say 1835 or something. If we started 1835, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40, and we just kept coming around one year at a time, and then at a certain point Robert Roberts joined the queue because he started to write, and so now we had two lines of books, and what we did is we then got an original copy of every publication that Brother Thomas had ever written and an original copy of something that everything that Robert Roberts had written. And guess what? That whole room was filled with books that two men had written. Absolutely astonishing. No computers. No Microsoft Word. No Logos software. Pen and paper writing. Studying of books, and they were both extremely well read, by the way. Brother Thomas had read an immense amount of books in all sorts of different fields of endeavour, not just biblical. And you came into this room and you felt absolutely humbled by the poverty of our own labours in the truth compared to the enormity of what these two men had done. The enormity of what these two men had done. And under the most difficult circumstances, because they didn't just spend all their time writing books, you'd imagine that's all they did. But of course they weren't doing that at all. That was the stuff they did in their spare time. The real work was preaching here, preaching there, travelling on horseback, by train, walking miles and miles to get to the nearest ecclesia. The debates, the controversies, the divisions, all the difficulties of ecclesial life. Robert Roberts and John Thomas had tremendous pastoral difficulties. All their lives they grappled with that. And yet in the midst of all that, they wrote a room full of books. Absolutely astonishing to see. Now, wouldn't you want a copy of all that? Just as a reminder to yourself of the heritage that we've come from, and these brethren laboured so amazingly. You want to have that. You want to have a copy of that. You want to recognise the enormous impact of that literature as the spiritual inheritance of our community and start reading it. So let's start with the easy stuff. Hands up those that have had a look at Elpis Israel. But if I said, hands up those that have had a look at Eureka, see how the numbers drop? And if I said, hands up those that have had a look at, well, I'll make it really hard for you, Odology. Well done, Jay. All right. Hands up those that have read Anastasis and Catechesis. Pretty good. Hands up those that have read Mystery of the Covenant of the Holy Land Explained. Hands up those that have read Last Days of Judah's Commonwealth. So, there's a bit of stuff here to read. In terms of the writings of Brother Thomas. And you know what? All of those books are superb. Absolutely superb. We've got a heritage of the truth here that somehow say we need to start reading some of that. Avoid the danger of filling your library with useless, worthless, or erroneous writings. Now, listen, I've done that. I would find certain books. You know what it's like. Again, I would make the mistake of going to a second-hand store, and there'd always be a religious section. I'd pull out a couple of books that looked promising, and generally they were trash, but because they were cheap, I bought them. So you have to have an occasional purge of the system and think, you know what, I'm never going to use this book again, and I should never have bought it in the first place, and it's time for me to confess that sin and move on. And besides which, if I pull that big fat volume out, think of the space that leaves on my bookshelf that I can buy a nice new, you know, shiny model to go into there. So that's quite, you know, it's got its pluses. And if you're going to have non-Christadelphian authors, find authors that write from a biblically conservative basis, and what we mean by that is that they believe in the inspiration of Scripture. Now, generally, IVP publications, the Tyndale Press series, will generally be considered to be conservative and written by people that believe in the inspiration of the Bible. So one of the series that I've got, if I was going to have a modern series, would be perhaps IVP Tyndale Press publications because of that conservative approach, whereas a lot of the other commentaries would be a waste of your time because they're probably written by atheists to start with. Focus on the benefit of building a physical library, not just a digital one, for the key reasons of accessibility and longevity. I think I mentioned to you earlier, and I wasn't joking, you probably thought I was joking, but I wasn't. My books are my friends. I've travelled through the travelling places of the Bible with those books. I've journeyed to astonishing places. I've wept and I've cried and I've smiled and I've been thankful. I've marked things, I've wrestled, I've grumbled, I've complained, I've rejoiced. Those books are my friends. I touch them. And you see, you know what's really nice? Someone will come to you and say, I'm doing something on Saul. Have you got anything on Saul? What would you think about for Saul, by the way? Where would you go to find something on the book of Saul? Or something on the life of Saul? Well, you'd probably think maybe Sunday School Association notes, there's got to be a chapter on Saul.
Samuel the Seer.
Samuel the Seer will probably have something on Saul. Michael Ashton, Samuel the Seer, could have something on the Saul. Actually, if you've got a commentary, you might find something on Saul. Do you know there's one of the very best chapters is called The Mind of Saul? You know who wrote that? It's by L.G. Sargent in his book A Sound Mind. It's got a whole chapter called The Mind of Saul. Spooky, interesting. But you see, the question is, did you know that Brother Sargent wrote a chapter on the mind of Saul? And you'll only know that if you've read A Sound Mind in the first place. So that when someone comes to me and says, good thing, I say, yes, actually, that volume there, there's a chapter on the mind of Saul. Have a read of that. How do you know that? Oh, I just do it. The reason why I know is because I've read the book. So one of my rules is when I buy books, I need to make a commitment to read them. So I would have, actually, I don't even know how many books I've got. Many hundreds of books, but I would have read, I think, 80 to 85% of them. And I've read them cover to cover so that I know what's there, and then I put it away. And generally, if I wanted to go back to that, I would say, about halfway in, about 200, I think this is something on in that book on that topic. Yep. All filed in my memory bank once I've read it in the first place. Now it's a useful resource in my system because I had to read it to know about that. Now when it gets parked on my bookshelf, it hasn't just disappeared to gather dust. I know what's in that book. I might not come back to it for some time, but I know what it can give me now. So I've got to read it to understand that. And so you want to appreciate the importance of deep learning and why this is only possible through deep reading and deep thinking. It's not achievable by what you might call mental scanning or copying. So this is where I'm a little bit suspicious at the moment of digital work. I don't think that, as I say, that the study yet will evidence that it's a good way of learning or remembering. So it's both comprehension and retention is not as good in the digital world as it is in the material world of a physical book. So I prefer to deal with physical books because I feel that I make a better fist of grasping and comprehending the material, wrestling with it, making it my own, and then remembering it. So I find, you know, benefits in computer technology, and I understand all that, but I don't have a passionate attachment to a computer screen the way I do to my precious volumes that surround me at home. I breathe in the atmosphere of their learning when I sit down. I think, yes, I'm at home. This is my sanctuary. It's surrounded. It's built out of out of books. A wall of books protects me. I think there's something about that that's lost in the digital world. So just be aware of it, that's all I'm saying. And particularly this bit here about deep learning, I think that the trouble with even... Now, look, I do the same thing. I've got Logos software, and so I like it for this reason, that I like to be able to say, I wonder who in the Brotherhood has written on this topic, so I'll put some words in. And boof, up will come the Christadelphian, and there's something in, you know, Nazareth Revisited, or there's something on that. And I like doing all that. But you know the trouble with that? Is you scan down, the words highlight, and what you're doing is you're skimming just that little bit of Nazareth Revisited, just the little snippet you want. But you've never read Nazareth Revisited, and you've never read this book, or that book, or this book, or that book. You're just snapping little bits out of the book, but you don't even know the context, because you've never read the book itself. I'd rather read the book. And as a result of that, then have a much better grasp of a wider context in which that comment by Brother Roberts actually sits. But of course, reading the book's much hard work. But in the end, I think that sort of cut and paste mentality will catch up with us in terms of the real depth of our spiritual knowledge. Too much cut and paste without deep thinking going on behind it will, I think, in the end, affect our quality. So become familiar with the deliberate use of both physical scripture references and digital search tools, and the idea is to transform your library into your primary scriptural information resource. Looks like I've got a typo there, so I better fix that. We read to take ownership of ideas. So the one thing I do like about this type of resource is this. Stop Googling. Build your own private, internal, Christadelphian Google system. Google that. That's why I like Logos software. Google the Brotherhood first and foremost. In fact, do you know what you'll find? That you can, and I don't know if you've done this, you can sift Google for information on a subject and you'll end up reading reams of trash to find one little wee interesting bit. And then you'll read an article by Brother Carter that trounces the lot of them. You think, why didn't I read that to start with? The answer is because you're foolish, that's why. But now you know, go back to Brother Carter next time. I've done the same with Brother Thomas, where I've looked at something and I've made a decision. You read Brother Thomas and you think, wow. Brother Thomas just makes an aside completely unrelated to what he's currently looking at, but he just tosses in a few comments and you suddenly think, hang on a minute, he's got three quotes hidden inside there. I know where those quotes are. What are you saying then? You suddenly realise that actually Brother Thomas has got the best grip on that little problem that I've ever heard of. And it was just a little side issue that he just comments about in brief on the way past something much more interesting as far as what Brother Thomas was dealing with. You mustn't neglect the richness of that heritage. So we want to provide our own scriptural information system. So how do you build a library? Well, I think there's some stuff, and this is how I built mine. So look, I'm not saying this is the only way. It's just, if you end up with all these books, you can't just have books. You've got to say, how will I sequence the books? So this is what I've done. So I started with exposition, and I've got expository works that I might say are foundation works on the truth, general works on the truth, and exposition of books of the Bible. So I have a big bookcase that's 1, 2, 3, 4 layers, and it would be from about there to about there. So it's quite a big bookcase. And that's the bookcase that I just have just for exposition of books of the Bible, Old and New Testament. So that's one bookcase, 4 layers, about that wide, books of the Bible. And then another bookcase about the same size where I have other general expository books. So I've got two main library resources, which I would call expository. And then we've got a reference section. I've got a special dedicated set of shelves for reference section, and I have reference for dictionaries, lexicons, translations, commentaries, atlases, history, geography, archaeology, and canon and manuscripts. So I have a reference section. You'll get a copy of these slides, by the way, free of charge, too. And so this is a good way, because you end up with a lot of this sort of stuff, and it's quite good to say, I know where my lexicons are, where my atlases are, where my geographical works are, so I can go to them straight away, because they're all customised into that particular shelf, which is the reference works. So that's another set of shelves. And then I come to another set of categories: pioneer, doctrinal, prophetic, thematic, apologetic, exhortational, devotional, practical. What's apologetic, by the way? You know what apologetic is? Yeah, so an apologetic is a book that's a defence of the truth. Anyone got Josh McDowell, Evidence That Demands a Verdict, or More Evidence That Demands a Verdict? So that would be an apologetic work. Actually, Blunt's Undesigned Scriptural Coincidences, Frank Morrison's Who Moved the Stone, they would be apologetic works. They're works to defend the veracity and truthfulness of the scripture. You'd probably say that Ramsey's stuff, actually, is a very good apologetic on the accuracy of Luke writing the book of Acts. I'd regard Ramsey as an apologetic in that context. So it's handy just to have, and I tend to have pioneer work simply because it's just great to go to Brother Thomas or Brother Robertson, they're there. I have expanded that a bit because I also have Brother Carter and Brother Collier and Brother Walker and a few others as well. So I have a slightly bigger pioneer section, not just the first two. But I have a pioneer block. And then by having all these into some semblance of order, it means that I can go to one place and all my prophetic studies or all my doctrinal studies are in that one place in terms of access. For practical, I have aspects of the truth in daily life and practical on marriage and family issues, because there's a number of books sort of around that topic, so I've tended to end up with a bit of a segment in that area. Looks like that's not quite the finish of the story, because I also have ecclesial and biographical and political and pictorial and botanical and Jewish and general and other religions and a heresy shelf. So this is where the dodgy stuff sits. That's under lock and key in case any other person comes into the room that shouldn't be seeing that stuff. But I might have that, for example, in terms of what other people say, even though I know it's wrong, just because I want the resource. And I do find that there were some books in our library, and no doubt they've been in your library. I think they may even come from the Christadelphian office, a book on Islam and a book on Buddhism, little wee books. But I think it's quite helpful to have a summary of other religions, because one day you might be asked to give a lecture on the Bible's answer to Buddhism. So it'd be helpful to have a book about Buddhism in that case, in terms of preparing that lecture. So I've got a section on other religions. So does that make sense? Now, as I say, I'm not saying that that's the only way to break it up, but those are some of the more obvious sections that I discovered that there was enough books to have a section for each of those parts, at least so far. So here we go. Here's a test. I'm going to close at the end of this test and we'll move on to the next section of the night. So I thought we'd just ask ourselves how well we know our literature. So could you name three books in the following categories? Now, we'll do it out loud, by the way, so you're not going to be judged in tables or teams. And you've already had supper anyway, so I can't punish you, so, you know. So if I was to say God Manifestation, can we name three books? Now, always within the Brotherhood, just within our own community. Three books in the Truths literature.
Phanerosis.
Jesse? So what were you going to say? You were going to say Phanerosis?
No. God Manifestation... title is by Jason Hensley.
Okay, so Jason Hensley's book on God Manifestation, yes?
Theophany
by C.C. Walker. Phanerosis by John Thomas.
The Divine Name. It's quite a large manuscript. It's quite a bit of size.
Okay, well, I haven't got a copy of that. Ooh, I haven't got a copy of that. I'll have to find out about that. Names and Titles of the Deity. Who's that by?
Mike Bolton.
Yes, there is one by that. And you may also regard Yahweh Elohim by Sister Lazius as related to the subject of God Manifestation as well. So I would think that if we really scratched their heads, we could probably find half a dozen books on God Manifestation. But it's good to know that. If someone said, what have you got on God Manifestation? Well, what have you got? What is the answer? Where would you be looking? What about the doctrine of the atonement?
Understanding the atonement by
Matthew Trower. Now, sorry, is that on your heresy shelf or? No, it was a very good answer. Very good answer. I couldn't have put it better myself. It was very good that you said that. I think it was the right thing to do for more than one reason. So, yeah, exactly. So. The Doctrine of the Atonement by Brother Matt Trowell. In terms of the pioneer writings, anything you can think of on the atonement?
Slain Lamb.
The Slain Lamb by?
Robert Roberts.
I have a particular predilection towards the Slain Lamb because he actually wrote the Slain Lamb in difficult circumstances. And if you're going to talk about the Slain Lamb, what's the other one you would quote?
The Blood of Christ.
The Blood of Christ.
Now, both of those are written in a height of controversy, and yet when you read them, they're so calm and so measured and so balanced, you think, this is amazing. You'd never know there was a controversy raging at the time that Robert Roberts wrote this this eloquent summary of the atonement in simplistic terms. Fantastic, yeah. Very good books. What about this one?
Melville Perkis.
Okay, so, now, by the way, Melville Perkis's book is called...
A Life of Christ.
Yes, so he did say A Life of Christ. What else on the Life of Christ? Yes.
Nazareth
Revisited by Robert Roberts. That's on the Life of Christ, yes?
L.G. Sargent has a book on Mark. I can't remember what it's called.
Yes, The Gospel of the Son of God. Green volume. L.G. Sargent, quite right. And we would consider that to be a book on the life of Jesus Christ. So that's three. Well done. We can move on. How about The Power of Prayer?
The Path of Prayer by John Morris.
Who?
The Path of Prayer by John Morris.
The Path of Prayer by John Morris. Spoken by a fine English brother who maybe have connections and would sort of bring that particular thing to mind, but we'll pass over there for the moment. All right? The Path of Prayer by John Morris. What else?
Cyril Tennant on Prayer.
Yeah. Yes, Cyril Tennant on Prayer. Okay, there's a book by Cyril Tennant on Prayer. H.P. Mansfield, Making Prayer Powerful. All right, so three books. So you've done three books. Well done on prayer. The Role of Israel. Oh, now that's an interesting one. Can you think of three works of the truth on the role of Israel? Elpis Israel. Well, I'd probably have to take that, wouldn't I? Mystery of the Covenant. You could take that as a dissertation on the future of Israel. Absolutely. By the way, Mystery of the Covenant, amazing book.
There's some great sections in Eureka.
Yes. And also we have Modern Israel by Cyril Cooper, and at least two other books about modern Israel written in recent times. I think there was one by Jeff Henstock in Australia, but published through the Christadelphian office recently in terms of the
site.
No, this is about Israel. It was an earlier one, right, before that. So there is a series of books about Israel, the nation of Israel, and its relation to the promises. All right, so you've done quite well on that. Now, let me make it more interesting. What about this? Three works of the truth on the book of Leviticus.
The Law is a Schoolmaster by...
The Law is a Schoolmaster by John Martin.
Yeah.
Law and Grace by W.F. Barling.
Law
of Moses by Robert Roberts. I'd have to accept that, although it's a more general work. What about the book of Leviticus particularly? I'd accept W.F. Barling's Law and Grace because it essentially is on Leviticus, because it's on the schedule of the law offerings.
John Martin has Leviticus.
Yes, we've already mentioned that. The Schoolmaster. By the person on Leviticus, the expositor. There's also Brother Michael Ashton called The Beauty of Holiness, which is an exposition on the book of Leviticus. So we've got a series of works on Leviticus. Pretty good. What about the book of Psalms? What have we got in the truth literature on the book of Psalms?
Mark Vincent,
all right. The book of Psalms, Exploring the Psalms.
Yeah, the two volumes that are done by Logos?
Three volumes, actually, by Logos. Yes, so, three volumes by Scripture Study Service. Are they the ones you're thinking of? So three volumes by Scripture Study Service, four volumes, written by, obviously, different authors, but three volumes by Brother Dudley Fifield, issued by the Christadelphian Office, also on Psalms. Two volumes by Brother Cyril Tennant, written on the book of Psalms. A book by Ern Wilson called The Handbook on the Psalms. Right. So there's a bit of a cascade of books from within the Brotherhood on the Psalms. Anyone in advance of that? What was that?
Dance of
Thirtle. Thirtle's the title to the Psalms. Right. Yep, absolutely. Yep. So we've got quite a good collection of good stuff on the Psalms. What about the Prophecy of Daniel?
John Thomas.
Exposition of Daniel, right? So we've got the name and the title, Exposition of Daniel.
Green Book.
The what?
The Green Book.
So he's talking about the expositor, all right? The reason why I was puzzled is because there is a very good book called The Prophecy of Daniel by Brother Edmund Green. So when he said The Green Book, I thought he meant Brother Green's book. And Brother Brian was suitably vague so that I could say, oh, yes, Brother Green, he would say, yes, of course. Yes, exactly. So Brother Edmund Green, very good book on Daniel as well. Now, there's some other works on Daniel which are a little more confusing and I think a little bit less helpful, but there are other books as well. But those ones you should have on your bookshelf. Got them all? Got them all so far, those ones? The Green Book, Brother Edmund Green's book, Exposition of Daniel, There's actually the set of, there's a set of notes by Bartholomew on Daniel, issued a long, long time ago, out of what would have been the precursor to Wayside Press. Was it VC Publications or something like that? Can't remember. The Epistle to the Hebrews. What writings have we got on the Book of Hebrews in the Brotherhood?
John Carter, John Martin.
John Carter on the Book of Hebrews. John Martin on the Book of Hebrews. Ooh, now this gets interesting. Brother Bolton wrote a book on the Book of Hebrews. Okay. So we've got at least three works on Hebrews, as far as I'm aware of. So I think we've just snuck through the Apocalypse of Jesus Christ. Apocalypse in History by Barker and Bolton. Good answer. That's a good one. Who would have got that one? Apocalypse in History. Yeah, so well done. That's sort of, you know, a bit left field, but who's got a copy of it? Okay, well done. So Apocalypse in History by Bolton and Barker. There's a second one, like unto it, but not quite the same. What's the second one called? Apocalypse and Gospels. Okay, so there's two of them from that same source. What else? Eureka by Brother Thomas.
Revelation, which interpretation?
Revelation, which interpretation by Graham Pierce.
Michael Ashton wrote a summary, like one of those.
The study guide on the Book of Revelation. Book of Revelation. Yep. And then there's some other contributions which are more doubtful in terms of their helpfulness, but there are other writings. But those ones would all be, I think, useful in terms of an understanding of the Book of Revelation. So the point is, and this is my question, number one, can you recite them? And number two, have you got them? If you haven't got them, you should get them. So buy the shelves and then fill the shelves in that order, probably preferably. What about these? So just bringing another way. So could you name three books by Brother Thomas? Well, that's pretty easy. Exposition of Daniel. Well done. Elvis Israel. Well done. Last Days of Judas Commonwealth. Well, that was good to have something a little bit different. So yes, you passed the test in terms of Brother Thomas. Well done. Robert Roberts.
Ways of Providence.
Christendom Australia. Well done. Nazareth Revisited. What was that?
13
lectures.
Life and Times of Brother Thomas.
Life and Times of Brother Thomas. Law of Moses.
Visible
Hand of God. We've got a few things there, haven't we, in terms of Robert Roberts. What about Charles Walker?
Isaiah.
Ministry of the Prophets, Isaiah. He wrote the bulk of it, so we'd have to say that it's Brother Walker's work predominantly from, was it, chapter 6 onwards? Brother Roberts wrote up to chapter 5. So C.C. Walker, what else did he write?
Isaiah.
Ooh. We've just mentioned that. Ministry of the Prophets, that's his dissertation on Isaiah.
Jeremiah?
Yes, he wrote a book on Jeremiah. Who said that? Daryl, well done. So he wrote a book on Jeremiah the prophet, and he also wrote Theophany, didn't he? Which is one of the books we've got on God Manifestation. So we just stuck in with three books by C.C. Walker. Actually, he wrote some other bits and pieces too, but generally those would have been his main publications. Brother John Carter.
Romans, Ephesians,
Galatians, Philippians, Hebrews. You'd be wrong on that, by the way, because Philippians, I think, is Brother Barling, but certainly Brother Carter is Ephesians, and it is Galatians, and it is Hebrews, but it's also the parables of the Messiah, the Gospel of John, and all of those are sensationally good works. You will never, ever do better than those works. I believe that Brother Carter is one of the most masterly scholars and masterly writers that our community has ever had. So, if you haven't got Brother Carter, time is stocked up on him. Brother Islip Collier, can you give me three books by Brother Collier?
Principles and Proverbs. Conviction and Conduct.
Fox Day. The Guiding Light. I'd accept all of those. Well, it looks like you passed the test, gentlemen. So well done. So, but you see, isn't it interesting that all those names come out now? Were those names all familiar to you, or do you think, well, I haven't heard of some of those? It's probably good if you haven't heard of some of those, because what it says to you is, hey, there's a whole body of literature here that needs to get stashed away in your library. And good librarians ought to be stocking this stuff and making it available to good, keen Bible students. So it would be quite good, you know, to... I always like, you know, the thought of negotiation. I think most libraries, if the truth be known, most ecclesial libraries have got old stock malingering away in the bottom drawers. It hasn't been sold, hasn't been dispensed with, hasn't been dealt with. You should go to your librarian and say, look, you've got a whole lot of stuff that's not going anywhere here. What about what about we talk, you know, I take some of these off your hands. To help out with the space for new volumes that will be arriving. And you might find that the librarian would be quite moved at your, you know, helpfulness. For a small fee, anything can be arranged. So the lesson is, if you're serious about Bible study, be serious about resourcing it. These books will become your friends. That's what they've become for me. Jesse.
Just because Brian mentioned the green book, but one of the positive attributes of having a physical book is amongst our community we know them as perhaps the shape or the size or even the color of the book.
Yep.
So if we say the green book, we know that that typically is an expository by Brother HB.
Yep.
The story of the Bible, the orange torch.
Yep.
So there's sort of a positive attribute actually like the physical book as opposed to maybe the digital version because it gives more real presence to it.
I think also one of the things I believe is that when you've got a physical book, I've got my physical books, and they've been with me for years. I mean, I own them and I possess them and I can reach out and touch them and I can pull them off the shelf and they're right there with me. And actually, I still find that I do my best work by opening books. I still prefer to have the book open. I don't like screen work. I find it difficult. In fact, do you do the same thing? If I actually am scrolling through Logos software and I find a good article, I'll print it off. And then I'll actually start making notations on the printed version. Because you can work with it. So there's something about the brain and how it works. And one of the things that I worry about is this. How many changes has there been to digital technology in the last 20 years in terms of filing and recovery of data and how it's done? So we've gone from reel-to-reel tapes to cassette tapes to CDs to flash drive. And what will the technology be tomorrow to retain stuff and keep stuff and organise stuff? But it keeps on changing. When I bought Libronics, you don't actually buy Libronics, so I bought the original disc from the Christadelphian office, and I thought what that meant was you put it on your computer and you had it under your control. I'd paid the money and it was mine on the disc. And then suddenly it's all been done through Logos software, and now Logos software want to sell me every package under the sun with all these amazing products that will help me to become a better pastor or minister or whatever it is that they want me to do. And I'm reluctant to, you know, to go platinum or bronze or anything. So I keep getting reminders saying, you're getting behind, buddy, you're getting behind. You only got the basic engine that keeps it all groaning along. I think, hey, I paid good money to the Christadelphian office for this, and I can see myself at some stage being dispossessed of my own digital library. Can you see that happening? I don't like the vibes. And now, you know, just so, but the books I've got are mine. Permanently mine, well, at least until I die. But I already had one son that's already made it clear that when I die, that the library's his, and he wants to make sure that's written into the will. But you see, they're real books. They'll survive any change of technology, and they're instantly available, you see. So you think I'm joking, but I'm actually serious. I think that there's dangers to how technology will change, and the Logos software stuff is a little bit concerning, that it's all under their control, and if I'm not paying a subscription to them at some stage, they might drop me off the system and actually I haven't got access to that anymore. So, by all means have digital access, because you can search. I love the search capacity. But having searched for it, I'd prefer to go and pull that volume down so I'll have a look in the volume things. Sorry, a comment?
No, you just made the point I was going to make. Because a couple of years ago, I started going digital. I forgot I bought the books digitally. And then you go to a Bible school and you're buying the same book again in a hard copy. Well, it's just age, right? Keep catching up with you. But the great thing about having it electronically is if you remember reading something or you're trying to find something...
Yes, you can. That's right.
It's really helpful to type in that phrase and remember and find the context to read it. So that's a great benefit. Right?
And I totally understand that. But my thesis is that often when you have digital copies, you'd never read them digitally. Like, who would read Nazareth Revisited out of Logos software? You just don't ever do it. You would never do it. First of all, you'd be driven nuts on the screen. Yeah. Right? But secondly, you use it for research purposes and to track stuff down, not to read. So,
but
yes.
I can take 600 books on a plane with me in this format, which I can't do from my library. So
that's true.
There are some advantages.
So let me give you the corresponding inverse advantage. Is on my 14-hour flight back to New Zealand from Houston, I will reach into my file, into my suitcase, and I will take out the one book that I will read on the way home, and I will devote my attention to that with a bookmark, and I'll do some deep knowledge work in that one book, and I may accomplish more on that trip than you will with the 600 at your disposal. But I rest my case. It's all about attention management. Shall we move to excellent readings? Because I'm dying to hear some more. All right. Shall we have a break for 5 minutes, stretch our legs, and then let's run into some.